Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the things that are going on over there. Also, if you want to come out to sunny San Diego in October, still some tickets left to Here We Still Stand, you can grab those. We would love to hang out with you. Very few left. They could be yours. And not only can they be yours, they can be yours for $25 less than someone who doesn't listen to this podcast. Because you can go over there to herewestillstand.org, register yourself, register your spouse, register your friend, register whoever you want, and then type in the code PNET19. PNET19 is in Podcast Network 19, and you'll get $25 off each ticket. So get over there, do that before those are all gone, and then you won't be hanging out with us in San Diego. Then you'll just be watching videos later on when they come out, being like, that looked fun. You don't want that. Nobody wants that. Get over there and do it. Chad, what is going on, man?
Well, I am getting ready for a week-long trip. Yeah, my son starts Naval Academy this week, so we're recording a day early because we're all taking off for Annapolis, Maryland, D.C., be hanging out with all the politicians later this week, I'll be in their backyard at least.
Yeah, well, you know, when we get done recording, I'll give you a list of things I'd like you to discuss with them.
Yeah, I'll do a little lobbying while I'm there. I'm sure I'll be rubbing elbows with a lot of powerful people.
Oh, sure, yeah. You're going as an ambassador from the nation of Texas, right?
That's right. Yeah, I told my son I got him he has to have a little U.S. flag on his desk in his dorm room at the academy. I said, well, that's fine. You need to make sure you get a Texas flag to go on the other side of your desk. You got to represent the Republic while you're there.
That's right. He could have like a little American flag on the desk and then like a huge Texas flag on the wall behind him.
There you go. But yeah, that's what's going on in our lives. We got a busy week coming up, but it's all good. It's all exciting times.
Yeah, well, right on, man. Well, what exciting things are happening in the Book of Deuteronomy?
Well, I guess a little bit of a segue here. We're not talking about politics, although we will later in the chapter, but we are talking about judges. That's where we find ourselves right now in Deuteronomy. We talked about most of chapter 16 last time, and we left off with verse 18. So we got two or three verses here that had to do with judges, and then a couple of verses that have to do with Asherah poles, which I think we've discussed before, but we'll touch on that as well. Then the next, and that's only like, I don't know, five or six verses. And then we'll jump into chapter 17, which is where we're going to hear what you do with a person who is been convicted of idolatry. And then we jump into some other matters after that. So, but what I'm looking forward to the most actually is the last part of chapter 17, where it comes to a discussion of Israelite kings. So some pretty fascinating stuff there.
Israelite kings before they had them, huh?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I don't want to get too much into it, but I mean it's a fascinating discussion because like they don't have any and they're not going to have any for a long time, but it's like, hey, if you ever do have a king, you know, if you go down that road, well, here's how it needs to be. So it's almost like Moses can already see what's coming.
Yeah, well, people love kings, man.
And yes, they do.
God knows it. Moses knows it.
Love that power. All right, so back to verse 18 of chapter 16. We got three verses here that had to do with judges, and most of this language we've encountered already in Deuteronomy says, you shall appoint for yourselves judges and officers. We're not sure exactly what the difference is between those two guys, but anyway, judges and officers in all your towns which the Lord your God is giving you, according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. All right, so I mean, it kind of makes sense, right? Got people scattered all over the place, and of course, disputes are going to arise, and so you need somebody who's going to be there to decide them. It's a whole lot better than vigilante justice or every man doing what's right in his own eyes. So you're going to have these judges. And when you have judges, of course, you also have something else. You have the possibility of injustice. You have the possibility of bribes. You have the possibility of showing favoritism either toward the rich or toward the poor. So it goes on and says, you shall not distort justice. You shall not be partial. and you shall not take a bribe, because a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Verse 20 says, justice, really, literally it's in Hebrew, it's justice, justice. But most English translations say something like justice and only justice you shall pursue, that you may live and possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you. Now, implicit in this, and this is something I actually appreciate, implicit in this command to appoint judges and the prohibition against bribes, is that Israel is not going to be, there's like an implicit acknowledgement here that Israel is not going to be some kind of utopia. I mean, so there's never any idea that, oh, Israel is going to be this perfect place where everybody's going to do what is right and everything will be just perfect and everybody's going to be equitable and there won't be any kind of problems that, you know, can't just easily be solved. Instead, there is an implicit acknowledgement, yeah, that things are going to come up. There's going to be some serious decisions that need to be made. And because of that, we need these judges. And also, there's an implicit acknowledgement that if you have human judges, you have the possibility of corruption. So you've got this prohibition against the taking of bribes. And elsewhere, we've seen, I think earlier in Deuteronomy, we've had this language of that you shall not show partiality even to the poor. You know, so just because someone, say there's a case against somebody who's rich and somebody who's poor, well, it doesn't matter. You know, if you tend to be the type that wants to lean, the kind of judge who wants to lean into the direction of the poor, Deuteronomy prohibits that because it's supposed to be kind of a blind justice, right? You don't look at the person, you look at the situation, you look at the facts of the case, and on the basis of that, you make your decision. Because a poor man is just as ready oftentimes to break the law as a rich man is. So this is this essence of justice, that it doesn't consider the person according to their station in life or their power or their lack of power, but instead looks at the facts of the case. But the main thing I like about this is the fact that we do have an acknowledgement that Israel is not going to be a utopia. Because, you know, if we've learned anything about utopias, especially over the last century or so, is that anyone who strives to create a utopia will actually create hell.
Yeah.
because that just means that, you know, if I'm out to create my own utopia, well, then I'm going to do whatever it takes to destroy anyone who gets in the way of my will to create a utopia.
Well, it's also this acknowledgement that God gave them the law, Chad. Is that not enough? I mean, is the law just, he told them how to act? Is this not enough?
All you need, right? Just tell people how to act and everything will be good.
Yeah, I mean, just give them the law and then bam, you know, everything's fixed, you know. God knows this is not the case. He says, here's the law. Now, you're also going to need some judges because there's going to be a lot of sin going on. Mm-hmm. Because this is what the law does. I mean, the law does not make people obey the law in and of itself. And you're going to have disputes arise. And not only are you going to have disputes arise, then you're going to have sin making more sin, where people try to bribe judges or get favors from their friends and all this kind of stuff. And so God is interested in justice. And again, like what he always says, he's like, this would be a good thing to do, that you might live long and possess the land which the Lord is given to you. So the idea is that The purpose behind this sort of thing is the quality of life of the Israelites. That corruption within your, in this case, your judicial system, it creates a less desirable environment to live in.
Yeah, I mean that's gonna have ripple effects that go out through all of society and gonna make matters even worse. Yeah, it's one of the comical assumptions that a lot of us still have today, is that if we can only make enough laws, then we'll be able to fix society.
Yeah.
Right. So we have this, I don't think it's always said explicitly, but there is sort of this assumption out there that if we just make enough laws to cover all the situations in life, then we'll be able to create a better society. Well, that's not the, I mean, that's like a fundamental misunderstanding of the law. I mean, the law has its place, of course, but creating laws to tell people what to do and what not to do is by no means a guarantee that these laws are going to actually make the people do what you're not supposed to do. In fact, as we know theologically, it usually has the opposite effect.
Yeah, you create laws that pertain to the things that people are most likely to do.
Mm-hmm.
It does not make these people less likely to do it. It just means that there's consequences for it. So this is on a societal level, we see that this is true. But on an individual level, this is true too. I mean, so when people look at someone and they're like, well, what, that person's just a big old sinner, probably what would fix them right up is if I just gave them a bunch of law. That's their problem. And you're like, that's not how this works.
You know, there's sort of acknowledgement of that, even in the life of Israel. You know, the number 613 is usually the number that is given for the number of laws in the Torah, and some of those are even repetitions. You know, so it's the same law repeated twice. But 613 is a typical number that's associated with how many laws there are in the Torah. And even if you think about it, that's actually not a lot. I mean, I never looked into this, but my guess would be that most towns and municipalities, cities have way, way more than 613 laws on their books. And we're just talking about like a city or a small town. Well, this is like a whole nation. This is God giving to Israel his laws, and, you know, 613 tops. Well, that's just like barely getting started according to the legal systems today. So there is a different understanding of law in ancient Israel, and it really even a different understanding of how judges were to conduct themselves. Of course, judges, I mean, they worked with the laws that God had given, but there's a much greater focus, at least in my reading of the Torah, much greater focus upon the kind of judge that you choose. He's to be wise. He's to be discerning. He's to be just. He's to be fair. And of course, he's to consider the law, but there's going to be a lot of cases, of course, where you don't have any kind of written code to exactly decide what is to be done. I mean, we even have cases in the Torah where people had to turn to God and say, all right, we got the situation. We don't know what to do with it. So what do you say? So it's a little bit different focus in the Israelite society about justice and laws and judges than we have in ours. Anyway, that's the first few verses. The chapter wraps up with a couple of verses that have to do with idolatry, kind of the popular religious options of the day. So verse 21 and 22 says, you shall not plant for yourself an Asherah of any kind of tree beside the altar of the Lord your God, which you shall make for yourself. Neither shall you set up for yourself a pillar, some kind of sacred pillar, which the Lord your God hates. Well, of course, this was, if you know anything about these Asherah trees or Asherah poles, these are referenced throughout the Old Testament, and we've encountered them already. This was sort of an Asherah pole was like an icon, this wooden symbol of a female fertility deity, which was very, very common in the culture of Canaan and in all the surrounding cultures as well. I mean, female deities were very popular, especially as they related to fertility. So this is basically saying to Israel, as we've heard multiple times, don't do that. Don't be like the nations who are around you. If instead of looking to some goddess or another god for that which you think you need from them concerning fertility or whatever it might be, well, you look to the Lord your God, because he alone is the source of everything that you need. And it's worth saying again just how weird this would have been in the ancient world. I mean, we have this still like in the times of the first century when the Jews were under Roman domination. One of the things the Romans could never understand about the Jews, and the Greeks were like this too, they could never understand about the Jews. I mean, what was so weird about them is that they only worship one God. Well, that's just strange. I mean, who in the ancient world didn't worship multiple deities? I mean, it was unheard of, almost unheard of, for a nation to be monotheistic, because everybody just was like, never even questioned that you would have multiple gods that you worshiped. So for Israel to come along and number one, only to have one God, and number two, not even to have an image of that one God, that put the Jews in a completely different arena, religiously speaking. So it might seem like obvious to us, like, well, of course you wouldn't put like the symbol of a goddess beside the altar of Yahweh. I mean, why would you do that? But for the Jews and for the people around them, that would have been like second nature. Of course you do, because you want to cover all your options. This God is good for that, and that God is good for this other thing, and this other God is one you turn to for this. So Israel stood out distinctively in the ancient world because of their insistence on monotheism. Now, today, we're the exact opposite, right? If we encounter someone who worships multiple gods, we think they're strange, but not in the ancient world. To encounter someone who worshiped only one god would have been strange.
Yeah, you don't see a bunch of raging debates between, you know, atheists and believers in multiple gods going on. The question is not, you know, in a debate form, whether gods exist. It's, do you believe in God? Just the way we phrase it is singular, yeah. You know. So I mean, it'd be real weird if you saw, you know, Richard Dawkins debating some guy that believed in tons and tons of gods. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could find that. I mean, you could debate, you know, someone over in Thailand or something, you know, and they still have that over there. But the Western world, the debate is, does God exist?
Yeah. So you can see even in our discussions with atheists today, the ongoing ramifications of, well, Jewish influence and then Christian influence throughout the centuries.
Right.
You know, it's one of the fascinating things is that about early Christianity is that the early Christians, and they were accused of lots of things. But one of the most fascinating accusations leveled against the Christians is that they were atheists.
Yeah.
And they were called atheists, not in the way that we think of it today. Of course, we think of an atheist as denying the existence of any divinity. But the reason the early Christians were that is because they denied the existence of all of the Greek and Roman pantheon. It wasn't like they didn't believe in any god. They were called atheists because they refused to believe in a multiplicity of gods.
Well, the way that it presented to the outside world was, these guys don't worship a god. They worship some guy.
Yes,
that was like walking around with them, and then like they somebody killed him, and like maybe he rose from the dead, maybe he didn't, but he's still some guy.
Yeah,
you know, like, I mean, he's a man, right? So like the fact that, you know, for Christianity that God, the incarnation is problematic for this whole thing, and you'll get called an atheist because you're like, well, that's not a god, that's a person.
Yeah, so we have to explain what Christianity is today to people who aren't familiar with it. But I think the situation that we face today is not quite the same that the early Christians faced.
No
one's going around calling Christians atheists.
Right.
But I mean, it doesn't matter what time frame that you're living in. I mean, there's always going to be people who misunderstand Christianity today. I mean, our main problem today is not that people are calling us atheists. Our main problem today is that people are just equating Christianity with a religiously moral system, and that's it.
Right? Yeah.
There's most people, when they hear, if they're not, you know, super familiar with Christianity, when they think about church or they think about Christianity, the first thing that comes to their mind is not, oh, those are the people that believe in the gospel.
Right.
I mean, nobody that I've ever encountered that is kind of wanting to know about Christianity, and they maybe know a little bit. The little bit they know is not, oh, you guys are the ones who are all about Christ crucified and risen. No, we usually have a bad reputation for whatever moral stance they associate with Christianity. That's about as far as most people get.
Yeah, it's funny. I was listening to Jordan Peterson talk to Bishop Robert Barron. He's a Catholic bishop. And that's an interesting conversation because it's one of the first times that he's talked to someone for an extended period of time that is obviously religious. And one of the things that Peterson said was that, and this is now, Peterson doesn't go to church and hasn't gone to church in a very long time. And he said that where he thinks Christianity blew it was that it became too much about grace and not enough about you know, getting your act together. And I thought, you're not going to the churches I went to, because that's all it's about. I don't know what you're talking about, you know. I mean, and he's talking about like very practical things, like, you know, don't be an alcoholic, don't watch porn, you know, like get your life together. I'm like, that's all it is.
Yeah, that's like 99% of what you hear at a lot of churches.
So. Yeah, man. But that's, so that was a weird criticism from someone who doesn't go to church, but I just thought that was really odd.
Yeah, that is, and that, of course, is not the kind of criticism of the church that we're familiar with. It's pretty rare for us to hear somebody criticize the church that's outside the church, criticize the church for talking too much about grace.
Yeah, well, and then of course, you know, Robert Barron, being a Catholic priest, was like in total agreement.
I'm sure he was, yeah. Probably what's happened is Jordan Peterson has been reading a lot of Christ Old Fast in 1570.
Probably. So probably he's been hearing about some rampant antinomianism running around.
I'm sure. All right. So that's chapter 16. We'll jump into 17 now. 17, 1 through 7. We talked about this in an earlier episode when we were discussing what do you do with the false prophet. So you got this prophet that comes along, and he claims to, of course, speak in the name of Yahweh, but his real goal is to draw you away from the worship of Yahweh alone to some sort of inclusion of other deities. So in that discussion, we did touch on chapter 17, these first few verses. This is a situation, where you got somebody in your town, and a man or a woman, it says, and they do what's evil in God's sight. But specifically, here's what it's talking about. Verse 3, this person has gone and served other gods and worshiped them, or the sun or the moon or any of the heavenly host, which God has not commanded. Okay, so we got somebody who, like I said, either sex, is a man or woman, and they haven't just like done something wrong. They've actually committed themselves to some kind of idolatry. They're worshiping, you know, Asherah, or they're worshiping Baal, or they're worshiping Moloch, or they're worshiping some of the elements of creation. I mean, you've got sun, moon, the heavenly hosts that are mentioned there, which of course were, the sun was like a big deal to worship in the ancient world. So you've got this person. What do you do? Well, you don't just like, oh, I heard a rumor about you know, that Joe down the street is an idolater, so I'm going to take my sword and cut his head off. You know, this is not the way it worked. Instead, it says, if you hear about this, then you inquire thoroughly, it says. You basically make sure that the situation is investigated, and you don't just go by the testimony of one person. It says, verse 6, on the evidence of two or three witnesses. This comes up, of course, in the New Testament as well. So you can't simply go by the word of one person. So it's two or three or more witnesses. That is the only way in which a person who's been accused can be justly tried for the accusation. So there's a twofold concern here. One is to prevent idolatry. They don't want idolatry spreading. And so if an individual is caught, well, then they make sure they deal with the situation. But they don't deal with the situation in any sort of peremptory fashion. Instead, they make sure there's a trial and that there's two or three witnesses, and they investigate the matter thoroughly. Now, that all being done, if the person is found guilty, then just like with other infringements of the law, this person is going to be put to death. And interestingly here, it says verse 7 that they're to be stoned. It says that the hand of the witnesses shall be the first against him to put him to death, which I think is meant to be a dire warning against people who are considering false testimony. Because if there's somebody you don't like, let's say, and you're trying to get back at them, and you think, well, I'll just accuse that person of idolatry. Well, if you're brought forward as a witness and you testify to that effect, not only are you lying, but you're also about to be guilty of murder, because your hand will be the first to cast a stone at this person. So it's a warning against someone thinking that they can simply sin in one way and not sin in another way. If you're going to lie, then you're also going to be the one who's going to be guilty of murder if you have lied about this person. That's the first seven verses of that chapter.
And that, you know, that seems rough. I mean, I will grant the listener, where you're like, oh man, like idolatry. And yes, we're all idolators. So this is true. But this is talking about like a more explicit act. This is not idolatry on the heart level. This is about, this is about someone who is going out and worshiping gods that, in many cases, these gods have horrific practices attached with their worship. We've talked about this at length, that will be detrimental to society if they start bringing other people into this worship. So, I mean, you have child sacrifice, you have all kinds of bad things that go down. And so this isn't, I mean, yes, God is about you only worshiping him because he's the only God. He is offended by your worship of other things. However, there's also an element of this, which is the spread of idolatry. And we will see throughout the pages of the Old Testament that when idolatry spreads, things are horrible. The ramifications of it are really bad. And so part of this is a first use of the law kind of thing, as we call it. It's a deterrent. It's to say, don't do it. Don't do this thing that, if it spreads through the community, will destroy the community. Don't do it, because the punishment for doing it is death. So it's the reason. It's just like laws that we have that says, if you do this thing, here's the consequence, and it serves as a deterrent to do that thing, because you don't want, everyone going 90 miles an hour on the freeway, because we're all going to die if you do that. So they put in deterrents not to do that, because if you're going that fast, you're going to not just get a ticket, but you're probably going to get arrested and you're going to lose your license and all this kind of stuff, right? So this is how it is with idolatry, but the penalty is severe. But that's part of the reason. The other reason, of course, is that there is no life in the worship of idols. Eternal life is only accessed through the one true God. And so there's also this deterrent trying to root something out that, again, you could potentially bring other people into that would have not just temporal horrific consequences, which it would have, but also eternal consequences of having people worship idols.
Yeah, I mean, that underlines the fact that Israel, we can't ever think of Israel the way that we think of countries today, right? I mean,
right.
This isn't just like some kind of society. I mean, it is a society, it is a nation, but at the same time, it's also the people of God whose very existence is grounded in the fact that Yahweh is the one who has chosen them and brought them out of captivity in Egypt to lead them to the promised land so that they might be his people. So if idolatry spreads, the very reason of their existence is annihilated. So that's why idolatry is the equivalent of what we would think of as high treason. I mean, you just can't, nothing is really worse than idolatry, because it cuts at the very heart of what makes Israel Israel, what distinguishes them from any other people. And that's, so if things like this bother you, you're like, man, you know, so much for freedom of religion. Well, there's no freedom of religion in Israel any more than there's like freedom in the church today to, well, if you want to worship Jesus, if you want to worship Jesus and also a Hindu god or a Muslim god or pick any god, that's not an option in the church, right? It just denies the very reason for the existence of the church if we try and have Jesus and another god. Well, it's like that with the Israelites as well. You can't have Yahweh and something else without almost immediately destroying yourself and those who are around you through the idolatrous influences.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the church doesn't execute someone for you know, deciding they're going to be part of another religion. But what the church should do is if you wander up in there and be like, hey, is it cool if I put this Asher pole up there next to the cross? Like, can I use your space to worship this other god? Well, no, they're going to probably tell you, like, hey, you can't be a part of the church if you're going to do that. Like, that's not how this works. So you're going to be put outside the church if you do that. And that's what happens here. It's just even more extreme.
Yeah. Okay. So that is the first seven verses. Verses 8 through 13 pick up the idea of judges once more. The basic concern here is, okay, you got this case. And for whatever reason, it's kind of a hard case. It's a difficult case for a person to decide. You know, it's kind of going back to our discussion in chapter 16. You got these village judges or town judges. And of course, there's going to be, you know, some cases are easy, some cases are more difficult. We still have this today in our law courts. So you got this really hard case. And, you know, it might be homicide or some kind of lawsuit or an assault or whatever it might be. Verse 8 discusses all of those. So what are you going to do? Well, if it's that hard a case, that difficult to decide, it says, here's what you do. Verse 9, you come to the Levitical priest or the judge who's in office in those days, and you inquire of them, and they will declare to you the verdict in the case. So you basically take it to the people who, it's a little bit unclear. Either they are deemed those who have greater wisdom and knowledge of the law, that's a possibility, or it could be a case where you have this difficult case, and so you go to the priest because the priest is the one who has the Urim and Thummim, or however you want to say that, basically the sacred lots or dice by which you can determine what God's will is. So the Urim and the Thummim, which were kept in the breastplate of the high priest, these were some kind of lots that were cast in order to determine what the will of the Lord was on a particular situation. So that it could be that this was why you went to the priest, so that they could use these divinely given objects in order to decide what the situation is going to be. And then verse 11 and 12 and 13 goes on to say, basically, if you take the case to these people, and this is what they say you are to do, this is what they teach you, this is the verdict which they render, well, then you don't have the option of saying, no, I don't like that decision. I don't like that verdict. Because if you do, it says you're acting presumptuously by not listening to the priest who stands there to serve the Lord your God. And so the penalty for that is not good. So if you take the case to the priest and the priest decides this on the basis of divine will, and you say, no, well, then actually it says the death penalty is applied to you. So if you go that far, then you listen to what the priest has to say based upon what God has to say. And there is like no further appeal. There's no higher court that one can appeal to than the priest who turns to God for the answer.
One of the things that you see over and over again is that it sure seems like capital punishment is, you know, the punishment for a lot of things. I mean, it's all over the place. There's a lot of laws that you can break where you get ended. And I think that what that shows us is that God is sort of doubling down on this idea that the wages of sin is death. You know, the day you eat of that fruit, you shall surely die. I mean, he starts off at the very beginning like that, where he says, I mean, what happens when you rebel against God is death. And whether that takes a long time to happen in the sense of eventually we die, or if it's in a judicial way like this, it's the same outcome in the end, which is as we rebel against God, as we sin, that the outcome of that is death. And I think that when Paul says, you know, the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life, he's able to, like, you know, look back on the law of God and be like, well, God is fairly consistent in his proclamation that you rebel against me, and what happens is you die. Again, this is God showing you that sin equals death. Like, sin will kill you, and this is how this works. This is not a gospel passage, you know. This is a law passage, and you will die, and this is why Paul makes a distinction between the wages of sin being death, as in the thing you've earned is through what you've done and failed to do is death, but the thing that God freely gives that you haven't earned is eternal life. That's a gift of God, and so when I read all this stuff, I just think, yeah, well. He said the wages of sin is death, and sure enough, that's what it is.
Yeah, sin is not like just a bad choice.
Yeah.
It's just not like an unwise life choice. It has eternal ramifications. And I mean, this is the way the law drives home again and again and again. The law is not about mercy. It's not about mere guidance, but instead it cuts to the heart of the seriousness of sin every single time.
Yeah, and you have here in verse 13 where it says all the people will hear and be afraid if this sort of thing happened, and they will not act presumptuously again. So you have two things going on. Like, one is that to drive home the point again that the wages of sin is death, and also to curb everyone's behavior and tell them, hey, maybe don't do this thing. Even if you're not good, this does not mean that people won't do this thing righteously. It doesn't mean that like everyone will be inwardly righteous and not be rebelling against God. But what it does mean is they won't take to action and do these things, which will be better for the society.
Yeah, and you know when you read later in Israelite history, you realize the fruits of what happened when these kinds of laws were ignored. I mean, you take just one example among many, the king Manasseh. It's almost like Manasseh read Deuteronomy chapter 17 and thought, you know what? I'm going to do the exact opposite of everything this says. You know, because he set up Asherah poles beside the altar of God, and he established altars to all sorts of different deities there at the temple in Jerusalem. He made some of his children pass through the fire, so he sacrificed them to Moloch. I mean, it's like there's nothing in these various prohibitions that Manasseh didn't do. Like he wanted to rebel in every single way, so he just proliferated idolatry in the nation of Israel, in the southern kingdom specifically. And the thing is, even though he lived to regret that, actually, as Second Chronicles talks about, what happened as a result of his actions had implications not just for him as an individual, but for the whole nation. So it's like we were talking about earlier, what happens is that when idolatry is not only permitted, but encouraged, then pretty soon every single fabric of society begins to break down. So that's why we have these constant repetitive warnings against idolatry. And that's why everything, one way or another, always gets back to the first commandment about having no other gods before him. And which is why when we get to the gospel, one of the aspects of the gospel that we sometimes don't really think about is the fact that in Jesus trusting his Father, in rejecting the temptation of the devil, for instance, to fall down and worship him, in instead worshiping his Father and his Father only, this was Christ's way of keeping not only the first commandment for us, but also all the other commandments as well, and then imputing that righteousness to us. So when we hear things like we do in chapter 17 about idolatry and the repercussions that come from that, we jump also then to what Christ did in keeping that commandment for us, and in being faithful to the Father on our behalf, so that his obedience and his righteousness are ours.
Yeah, I mean, once you obliterate the first commandment, the first commandment is a huge domino. And so once you decide that I don't have to worship this God, once that's true, neither do you have to listen to what he says, which means you don't need to love your neighbor, which means you don't need to worry about orphans and widows, which means you don't need to worry about not perverting justice. You don't need to do any of these things. I mean, if that's not the God you worship, then forget the whole thing. And then you do have a society where you just do what's right in your own eyes, which we see over and over again is the worst kind of thing for everyone.
Yeah, nobody wants to live in that society. absolute mayhem.
Exactly. And that's it, man. That's 40 minutes. Guys, if you enjoy the podcast and you'd like to help out with supporting the podcast, you can do so by going over to any of the sites and going to the donate link, and you can become a contributor there. Thank you so much to those of you who do that and make it possible. We will see you next week.
See you then.